It's that time of the year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The show will be back with new episodes at the end of February, but each week until then, we will be re-airing some of our favorites from 2024. This week's nice replay is episode 347, A Slow Meat Computer, King Making Thinky Bits Off-Screen Gameplay. Originally published May 16th, 2024. I'm still trying to understand what Ellen was talking about when she was talking about Thinky Bits. I still don't know what that means, and I'm hoping a re-listen will make that clear.
It's right there in the parentheses, Stephen.
Oh, right. Off-screen gameplay. Right. That makes it clears it up completely for me. No, it doesn't. I still I'm going to have to listen.
We did have a whole conversation as to what to call the topic.
We did.
Which is why it has a parenthetical.
Yeah. Actually, I think Dale came up with Thinky Bits.
Yeah.
As the name. So thank you, Dale, for that.
It's perfect.
But what I mean is, like, this topic in particular still eludes me as to what exactly we're talking about. And I was having difficulty during the episode trying to figure out what this means.
Yeah, meanwhile, I leaped on it. And I love this, but I also didn't understand it as much as I thought I did.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were coming at it with probably you knew more than you thought you did, and I knew less than I thought I did about what Ellen was talking about.
Yeah.
And Ellen is there, like, traffic copying us, like, the whole episode.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, it's a fun listen for sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably a good thing we're all going to listen to it again so we remember what that
is. Yes. The show will be back with new episodes at the end of February. While you wait, you can get these nice replays and all our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Okay, so we teased something last roundtable episode that we need to make good on. So there was a fire in the office building.
Yeah.
We're okay.
We're fine, obviously, because we're in an episode. But
fair.
I mean, I guess it's not fully fair, but anyway.
Well, actually, I think we should also say we're in the clubhouse and the clubhouse is fine.
Also true. So was the office, frankly. Yeah. It has survived this. So the office is above a restaurant called Masu. It's a Japanese restaurant. They have sushi and stuff. And they had a grease fire. Was it a grease fire? We don't know the details
kitchen
of the fire.
Investigation ongoing.
Yes.
Accident.
Some form of kitchen fire. Yeah, an accident. They have a little sign up that's like, it's an accident.
So we closed.
Yeah. They're closed
Sorry.
Right now.
Sorry, folks.
Yeah. But it caused, I don't remember the specific. It ended up causing some flooding to our part of the building, right?
Well, yeah. And that's the fire department's response. So okay. The smoke went through their chimney, billowing out of the roof, causing some damage. And then the fire department, part of their response is to overreact a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? And that's important, actually. Exactly. And so they're, you know, got the fire out, but also through the systems in the building, the HVAC and the chimney and all that. And so that created some unpredictable water damage in the building.
I see.
Which mostly spared the Noble Robot office,
thankfully.
But it meant there were lots of loud fans running.
Yeah.
If anyone's ever had, a waterline break in their apartment or something, you kind of know what these things are.
Yep.
It's big box fans that are sort of industrial. It's a bunch of them just all over, just blowing.
And they just run for
lots of noise.
Yes.
Including today when we were recording some other episodes. We're far enough away that it's not getting on mic, which is nice.
Yeah.
But the whole building is noisy.
Yes.
As a result, all week.
I was on a call when I first arrived this morning. It was like around 10:30, 11.
Mm-hmm.
I don't keep up with the office space chat because most of the time I'm not at the office. I'm up in Duluth.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good lesson for me to check the office chat before I come in.
Yeah.
Because I came in and I'm on a call and I came over by like the not the side entrance that we often come in. It's actually closer to Noble Road, but by the main entrance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I come out, there's a fan down there. Oh, gosh, that's loud. Okay, go by really quickly. And then I go up the stairs, and there are more fans. And I'm on this call. I'm like, oh, my God, it's so loud. I'm so sorry. Oh, my God. And, like, running through this gauntlet
of
fans.
Goodness.
I'm, like, ducking things. There's a fan over here. And there's a fan over here. And I, like, just sprint past the office, and I end up by the other door.
Oh.
Because that was the only place that was quiet.
Yeah.
They're really loud.
Yeah.
They
are loud.
Really loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still piecing together what happened. Mm. And we're trying to get more answers out of the building management, and presumably they're trying to get some answers out of the restaurant.
Right.
But yeah, could have been a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Yeah.
But it was funny. I heard about it on Reddit.
Yeah.
Like the local Minneapolis subreddit. Someone was like, oh, that building's on fire. And I'm like, what?
excuse me?
And of course, there was not a lot of information there. People were like, various... you know how Reddit is.
Right.
People say things and it's not exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, anyway, so got some official information. I'm now, I sort of was, I did give the business pretty hard to the building management about their lack of communication.
Reasonably so.
And they've been better the past day and a half.
Okay.
Responding, picking up the phone.
Thank goodness.
You know, sending out updates and stuff. So that's good. But yeah, it's been a weird week here at the office in the clubhouse. There's also been a lot independent of this disaster that, you know, we were spared the worst of. Mm-hmm. There's also been a lot of road construction on the Hennepin Avenue here where we are in the city, which is, in fact, I'm really excited about.
Okay. All right, because this is the new line.
There's well, there's a couple of things, actually. Okay. So we're on the a corner of Hennepin and 4th Street Northeast, and both roads are getting a big upgrade. New protected bike lanes, which I'm so excited about because it's actually kind of, this area is nice, but there it's not, doesn't have the best bike infrastructure, like right here on this block.
Yeah.
And now it's going to have the best in the city pretty soon.
Oh, awesome.
Really, really pumped.
It's good for you.
Yeah, directly protected bike lane from here straight to downtown, and then the other way along 4th, well, university going the other way, directly to my apartment.
Sweet.
So it's going to be great.
It's like a little bike freeway for you.
Yeah, exactly. And then on top of that, also along university and 4th, which goes from here to St. Paul. This is local flavor for folks who are not around here. But all the way into right on the border of St. Paul where you live, Stephen, the new BRT is going to run from your place directly here to the
office. Really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
That'll be great.
And so really good. We have light rail in the city. We have two lines of light rail, pretty light for a metro train system. Mm-hmm. But we also have BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, which is essentially a using buses, but also providing them dedicated lanes, also traffic signal control on the actual buses. And so it's essentially meant to be a really cheap way to get light rail style service with existing infrastructure. And Minneapolis has kind of gone all in on this.
Yeah.
We have a bunch of light rail lines, BRT lines.
Yeah.
And they're putting in new ones. And the E line is the one that's going to pass through this neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's there's a listen to this really interesting interview with some of the city planners talking about how, like, you know, it's you just can't, when you're an urban planner and, you know, you really want good urbanism in the city, you kind of can't wait. You got to just use what you got. You got to, and sometimes that means giving up on a dream on something, on a bigger system, right? Because there are a lot of critics of BRT as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm excited about it. It's already been a successful program in the city, and it's getting better, and it's coming right through the area, which is I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
Anyway, so all of that is a preamble to say that during the road construction that's happening on this block, the 5G tower that our business internet points at is offline starting now and all through the summer.
Yeah.
So we don't have any internet at the office, or we didn't rather. Mm. And so I had to go in and get this is like sort of boring for people who don't deal with this sort of thing, but like 5G on your phone is pretty fast.
Yeah.
But it actually a proper setup competes really well with like cable internet or even fiber. It's very fast, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but it's got it. You have to have this, you know, we have a device on the roof that points at a tower. It's not just like having a modem on your phone. It's a little bit more sensitive. And so we have that set up, and that's not working now because of the node that's in the line of sight of that is offline for a while. And so I got I signed up for a service from a competitor that wasn't available when we first signed up. Mm. And it's cheaper, and they have a 2-week free trial. So I'm like, that's kind of interesting because what all the installation.
Yeah.
Turns out, no, it's just a router and the modem's inside of it.
Oh.
So it's much lower. It's a much less enterprise service.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out, though, the tower for this provider is like behind the wall, like here in the building. Like it's just, we're right next to it.
That's perfect.
So we put it next to a window, and it's a little bit faster than the old internet. So kind of worked out.
Just do it the whole time.
Yeah, but like, I mean, this is boring to mention, but it's like this week has been a bunch of crazy things.
Yeah.
Including today, where we had a power outage here at the office.
Yeah.
That was wild.
And not understanding if it was related to the potential fire damage or water damage or anything like that. And so, you know, we're recording an interview today when the clubhouse went dead.
Yeah, that was, it was nerve-wracking.
But we electrician came out and real nice guy named Bob. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Got everything all figured out for us, and also was like, hey, this breaker, none of these are labeled correctly.
Yeah.
So did a little infrastructure work for us.
Thank goodness for that, too, frankly.
Which is going to make future problems easier to solve.
Yeah.
So it turns out microwaves and heaters use a lot of power.
Yes.
So I guess just keep that in mind when you're using them.
Don't put them on the same circuit.
Yeah, right. Don't put them on the same circuit.
Yeah, when you're adding power outlets to an office and the tenant, meaning me, mm-hmm. tells you what they're going to use them for,
uh-huh.
maybe actually separate things out correctly like you're supposed to.
Think it through a little, like, yeah. I yeah. don't know.
Yeah, that was pretty... It was also kind of hilarious. Like, the power went out while I was conducting a job interview. We were like, we're working on hiring someone for
yeah.
the team.
Yeah.
And I had already done, like, I was mostly just kind of a ride along, but I would have, you know, trying to facilitate this introduction.
Right.
Because I was like the main point of contact for this person. And then it just like everything froze and the lights went off. And I went, so then like Mark and I were like dancing around the office. Yeah. I was trying different outlets. And then my laptop, because it's a total, you know, energy hog, was running out of battery. And, oh, and Mark's trying to plug in the internet.
I saw that message pop on your computer, like, please plug in now. I'm like, oh, boy.
Yeah, no. It's pretty funny.
We ran an extension cable out into the hallway. And
yeah.
And we made it. We got through the afternoon before it was fixed. Yeah.
Put my laptop down on the cord for the space heater and shut the space heater off. And yeah. Mark's like, you did this. And I'm like, oh, God. In the Benny Hill music, I could hear it.
Yeah.
That was me. I was playing that.
Oh, good job. Yeah. Hold on.
So all that to say is that we've had a bit of a week here at the office and a bit of a day as well.
Yes.
So we're going to have some fun talking about some fun stuff.
Yeah.
And for Steven, you already talked about Dragon's Dogma 2
and I will in a recent episode.
Why is it here on the list? I thought we did this already.
It's so good.
Okay.
So fun. Okay, look. Okay. I haven't properly talked about Dragon's Dogma 2 because I feel like other things have come up. Maybe I have. I don't know. It all blurs together.
It's hard to tell anymore.
Yeah. But look, I really like the game and I want to sing its praises because, like, mm-hmm. it's just very fun. I don't know. It reminds me, actually, I was telling my brother this. It reminds me of, like, when I was playing on the Xbox 360 in my parents' basement after school. Like, I don't know. It just brought me back to that time because it feels like they just took an Xbox 360 game and they updated the graphics.
Kind of cool.
So it just feels good for me in that way. Uh-huh. Like, it feels nostalgic, too. So it's just a very satisfying experience for me to play through it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there are some changes, but, like, I don't know. It still feels very, very similar.
Yeah.
And I was surprised at how much I remembered that experience once I started playing it. So it just felt, yeah, it's just cool. I don't know. I think it's just really fascinating to have that experience because, like, I mean, with most, like, especially popular games, Dragon's Dogma was not, like, ridiculously popular, but it was kind of popular.
Mm-hmm.
And it had its own, an MMO, Dragon's Dogma Online, that ended a few years ago. So, like, it was popular enough to have an MMO version of it. But, it's not so popular that, like, games come out very frequently. So, like, I have nostalgia for Kirby, but, like, Kirby games come out within 2 years.
Yeah.
But Dragon's Dogma, like, there hasn't been an actual proper new game since.
Yeah, there'll be, like, a Kirby game, and you will be like, eh. Like, I'll catch the next one.
It depends on the Kirby game. But sometimes I am like that, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, it's, like, there hasn't been a Dragon's Dogma game for 15 years.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's like that's a
that,
lot of why.
It goes a bit of way to explain, because that's the 360 era.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's just been good to play mm-hmm. through it.
So I've heard you talk about Dragon's Dogma 2 for, like, a proper long time.
Yes.
Both on the show and off.
Yes.
What's this game?
That's fair. I haven't explained.
Like, I don't know what's the characters. I don't know the setting.
All right.
I assume there's a dragon.
There is, in fact, a dragon. So effectively... Yeah. The
and
game.
A council of clerics who write down rules, probably. The rules of that dragon, I would assume.
You think.
And I know there's not really good fast travel. Like, I know.
Right. That's about all I've explained. So the narrative of the game is silly, and frankly, you should just ignore it.
Okay. All right, moving on.
But, like, basically, the game is this dragon comes down and, like, challenges people to duels. And then you are the one who actually takes it on. And then you get beat down.
Yeah.
And then the dragon takes your heart and eats your heart and is like, you know, you're arisen. And then there's a bunch of pawns that, like, help you get better so you can fight the dragon, basically, is kind of the story. And then there's, like, a little more depth to it. But the depth actually makes it even sillier than it sounds now. So cool. I'm not even going to get into that.
Okay. That's not what you're here for.
That is not why I'm playing the game. The story in the first game was also actually less silly than this one, if you can believe it. Yeah, I don't know. That's the one thing that I feel like is worse, is the second game just has a weirder story.
Yeah.
That makes even less sense.
Right.
But I don't know. Like you said, you're not playing it for the story. You're playing it for the gameplay.
Sure.
Playing it for the experience. Yeah. And what I like about Dragon's Dogma 2 is like the actual narrative, the stuff that you tell people about the game is not the story that it's telling, mm-hmm. but the story you experience while you're playing through the game.
Ah.
Those are the kinds of games I prefer and like. So
what they call a user story.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, so this is like a third person action RPG?
It's a third person action RPG.
Okay.
It's a little bit like Monster Hunter. Because like you fight big dragons and other creatures and stuff. Uh-huh. And you can climb on them and beat them up.
Oh.
So like that's a lot of the fun of it. But you also like create a party of people. So it has a feel, it kind of feels a little bit like D&D in that like you can like create a group that you're partying together with.
Yeah. Is it a multiplayer game then?
It is not a multiplayer.
Okay, okay.
It's single player.
That's the milieu rather than the mechanic.
Yes.
Neat.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun. I can't recommend it to everybody because it is, I think it's for kind of a specific-ish audience.
Right. But everyone who recently turned 30.
Yeah, maybe give it a look.
Seems like it's the thing for you, perhaps.
You know, my brother recently turned 30, and he doesn't like Dragon's Dogma, so. Oh,
okay. He's not doing it right.
He's not. I keep telling him. Mark, you have been playing Princess Peach Showtime, and I've been meaning to ask you about it. Because I'm curious about that game.
It's fun as hell.
Yeah?
Yeah, and it's definitely, I mean, it's very much my kind of game.
Sure.
Which is like, it's, I mean, I have many types of games, but one of the types of games I really like is the sort of chill, like, hangout game.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it is.
Okay.
It's very linear. Okay. I mean, it's essentially part of its theming is like, you play through different staged plays.
Sure, yeah, right.
And Peach will dress up as the hero of that play, mm-hmm. and then you get a particular power. There's one action button and a jump button.
Okay.
It's very simple.
Cool.
And the story is also fairly light, but also it's efficient.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like there's not it feels like it's the exact amount of story for the amount you see.
Sure.
So it's good. It's really well balanced in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like it. I'm still not all the way through it. It's not a game that would take you that long, but I still haven't been able to put a lot of time into it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely like a hangout game where you're just kind of like, it's almost kind of going through the motions a little bit. Like,
okay.
There are challenging components, and like any Mario franchise game, there's you could play through it or you could play through it and get all the stars, right?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
In this, there's like 15 of these bonus stars you can collect as you go through. So it's a little bit more than like the 3 challenge coins in a Mario level.
Yeah.
And so there's a little more hunting and looking around.
Okay.
But it's not, there's not a lot of like hidden passages or any, you know what I mean? It's as a platformer, the staging is quite light.
Yeah.
To use a term, staging.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of opportunity for, I mean, you can pretty much look around. It's not hard to find a lot of these things.
Oh, yeah.
But there are so many of them, you kind of have to keep on.
Okay.
And so I wanted to mention this a little bit when we were talking about player friction.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that it does that is not, didn't really fit your topic, but it reminded me of something where it's friction in not a good way, which is that because the levels are so linear.
Yeah.
And it's also played out in like, not quite like screens, but like sections. So you'll play through a section and then you'll exit stage right and then the next section.
Yeah. Right?
And sometimes that will introduce a new mechanic and sometimes it'll just be the next section.
Yeah.
And it's not really predictable how long some of them are short, some are longer. And then all of those could put together make up a level.
Yeah.
And there's like a climax, either a boss battle or a final challenge. And so that's super, like the pacing of it's really fun.
Sure, yeah.
But if you get past, if you go to one section and you missed a couple of them stars, you cannot go back.
Oh.
There's no backtracking in that sense. And you have to start the level over, or you have to complete go through all the level and then go back.
Yeah.
And so there's this moment of like indecision. For a game like this, that's pretty easy.
Yeah.
I tend to be a player who likes to do the 100% on the first go.
Yeah.
And if I can't, especially if I'm like 90% on the first go, like I'm like, ugh. If it's like 60% on the first go, then I'm like, oh, well, I'll just play it again later.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm so close, and I'm just like, ugh.
Well,
and so there's this like moment of decision paralysis where I'm like a third of the way through a level, and I missed the second of 12 stars.
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, I could just... And there's like a cutscene at the beginning of these levels too.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. And it's and the actual amount of... That irritation is pretty low,
sure.
but it's also scales with the sort of lightness of the game.
Yeah.
And so it still feels like you don't want to do it.
Yeah, I see. So
that has been a little bit frustrating. But I've also tried to be like, well, ideally, you are just supposed to keep going. The levels are short enough, and you can get all of them on a second run through, which is fun. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed some of the second run throughs. Mm-hmm. But when I know where a star is and miss it, or I had no idea and I missed one.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I didn't even know I had to look. Like, if I'd have thought to look, I would have found, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit strange. But I'm trying to be like, it's definitely one of those things in games where it's really hard to calibrate player motivation for stuff like that. There's so many bonus things don't feel like bonuses to a lot of natural playthroughs.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Even though, and there's not a great solution to this, but so many games have this.
There's a topic there. For sure.
Yeah.
But I definitely see where you're coming from, because I could think of games like that.
But likewise, I couldn't imagine changing that game where you could exit stage left and go back to that earlier section.
Yeah.
Because it would break a lot of sequencing.
Right.
Because one of the charms of the game is, because it's so linear, you get to see lots of little mini cutscenes and sequenced character movements and stuff like that. That's part of your progression through.
Yeah.
And so going back wouldn't be, you know... You'd have to break a sequence in order to bring up the scenario where a lot of these things would be. And so rather than allowing you to go back when you don't break a sequence, that's just a standard, this is how it works.
Right, okay.
Which is the right decision, but that's the fallout from it.
I see. Okay, yeah. I see. So they had to make that concession, but that feels like a thing. That was a concession they made, and that player friction like I was talking about.
Yeah, and because I haven't had a ton of time to play the game, that is usually when it comes to that point where I have to decide whether to start over a third of the way through level or keep going.
Yeah.
That's usually when I'm like, oh, I'll just pick it up tomorrow. Mm. Because then it won't matter. I'll just start it over tomorrow.
Yeah.
Rather than starting over now, which will kind of feel not as fun.
Sure.
So that's maybe part of the reason why I haven't gone through it. I just haven't felt an urgency.
Okay.
To barrel through it, which is probably good.
Well, it's interesting how that's... I appreciate you sharing how that's affected your play, because it's an interesting case study.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Ellen, why are you making a face?
Well, I was looking for, like, screenshots from Princess Peach Showtime.
Yeah.
And it's just like not easy to glean the gameplay from all the screenshots that are shared online.
I would describe Princess Peach Showtime as a beat 'em up.
Cool. Oh,
really?
Basically. Love it.
Yeah. Very, I mean, you know, it is not challenging in any sense.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, like the classic like Ninja Turtles.
Or sure. Street like a brawler kind of thing.
Brawl, yeah, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And there's, you know, like a wave of six enemies will show up and you just pop, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And that's pretty fun.
Okay. Yeah, that's satisfying.
And every level, Peach has a different weapon. So it's all, you know, it's all still pretty simple. And one of the things that makes it really nice is because the mechanics cycle relatively quickly, but they're also very easy to pick up or almost incredibly intuitive, or rather they're so forgiving of like button mashing or, you know, the game is able to throw that variety at you because it doesn't slow you down.
Yeah.
The way it would in a more mechanically rich game.
Yeah, okay.
That way it would slow you down. You'd have to learn it and optimize it. That's why you can get the 100% on the first playthrough, because it is actually pretty easy to pick up because it's not that complicated.
Sure.
And that variety is more just fun rather than expanding the gameplay.
Kind of sounds a little bit like a Kirby game.
That's a good... In fact, the development studio that made the game also did Kirby's Epic Yarn.
Oh,
and,
really?
And Yoshi's Woolly World.
Oh, okay.
So, which are both very similarly like fun, charming takes. Yeah. I would say this is probably the most pure version of that yet.
Cool.
Which is to take a Mario or Mario adjacent character
and
just make a hangout feel-good time rather than provide a ton of challenge.
Yeah.
I would say the Kirby and Yoshi games probably are a little bit more traditionally platformers, even though they are also pretty easy.
Okay.
This one is definitely just, it's just a hangout game and it's really fun.
I wanted to check that out. I will invest time in playing that.
you're calculating how many spare minutes you have that it's not taken up by Dragon's Dogma 2.
Basically, yes. Yeah. All right, I got a topic.
Okay.
My topic is kingmaking, but Ellen is supposed to guess what that is.
Yeah,
she doesn't know what it is.
Right, you explained this to me. It's a term from like tabletop gaming.
Mostly, a lot of times it does. Yes.
Yes, but
I don't want to explain too much.
I don't know if it's like I've heard it before and it just didn't stick.
Okay.
Or what? But like I don't recognize this term at all. It is not ringing any bells. So I'm supposed to guess what it is, and it means you get the special ability when you have the best score. That's my guess. He's laughing. He says
that's
super
not it.
No,
that's not
okay.
What it is. Yeah, sorry.
What I like about that explanation is that I cannot make heads or tails of it.
If you have, like, you're in the lead, right? That means you get, like, a super cool ability or something while you're in the lead.
Oh,
if you
I
lose
see.
The score, then you don't
because
have that
often in multiplayer games, if you are the leader, you'll have a little crown over your head.
Oh, I'm
seeing the connection now. Okay, is that what you were
Well, yeah, you'll have a little crown over your head if you're in the lead. Yeah, that can be it. But I guess I was thinking one step beyond that, which is, like, when you're in the lead, you get something cool.
Yeah.
Got it.
You get to do something
cool. Oh, you know what we should do? We should give her clues until she gets it.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
Okay. Topic. You do what you want. But
do it.
First clue, kingmaking is something that a player does to another player.
Oh, boy. It's like the granting of terrible responsibility.
Accurate, but not fully accurate.
Okay, so I'm closer.
You're closer.
Okay,
yeah.
I need another clue.
Okay. I'm not good at coming up with clues. Okay.
Somehow we turned it back on Steven.
Great. It's a thing that only takes place in games with at least three players.
Oh, boy. What? So you can't have kingmaking if you only have two players.
Correct.
Right.
Well, that just throws my whole chess hypothesis out the window. Okay. Oh, so you're doing something. You're granting responsibility to one player instead of another player.
It's getting close.
Yeah, that is pretty close.
Okay, so you give an ability. You have a thing, and you can grant an advantage to one opponent versus another.
Yeah,
that's really good. I'll give you one more clue, and I think this will probably be it.
Okay.
Is if you're the person who is doing the kingmaking, there's little else you can do in the game.
Oh.
It's about your only thing.
What? Okay, so, like, that makes me think of a game where, like, games where you have been playing, and you're all playing together, mm-hmm. and then, you know, because you're me, you suck at it, and you're out of, you can't, you're like out, but you're not completely out of the gaming. Instead, right. you have some influence over the playing dynamics, like the dynamics of the players who are still in the running to be the winner.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so you can pull a card, you can, like, I don't know, some small mechanic that gives you, like, a really limited decision that lets you, like, dole out advantages to some person versus the other person.
That's exactly it.
Yeah,
yes.
You crown the king.
We got there.
So the definition I typed up is when a player who does not...
It was right here in the document the whole time.
I know. Yeah, I told you I wasn't going
to
read it.
I appreciate that you stuck to that. The definition I put down is when a player who does not have a chance to win can determine whether another player is able to win.
Cool.
So yeah, it's effectively granting advantage to somebody when you are definitely not going to win. Yeah.
And pretty often, it's such that you are the, not always, but if you're the person who's the kingmaker, it's essentially only your decision.
Yeah,
in a lot of games, it's such that the other two players have very little influence over who wins.
Yes.
Only the losing player does. Not exclusively, but very frequently, that's when it starts being called kingmaking.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been playtesting this locally made game called Harvest Kingdom. It's a 4X game, and it's got some of this. Ben Hunter, I guess this came up on his YouTube feed or something, and he brought it up because he felt like Harvest Kingdom was, like, afflicted, quote unquote, with kingmaking.
Yeah,
and I mean, I was arguing against that. I don't know. It's kingmaking isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just a symptom of what the game is.
Yeah,
I thought it was interesting. Like, watching that video, they effectively brought up all the points that I was going to bring up anyways. So it was interesting to see that video, and I wanted to talk about it. So we explained what kingmaking is, explained that it requires at least three players because, like, two of the players need to be in the running, one player needs to not be in the running, mm-hmm. and help make the decision on who does win. But effectively, this is an issue, quote unquote, again. I'm saying that because, like, it's really just an effect of all free-for-all games. And oftentimes this takes place in board games. This is a lot of stuff that, like, board games tend to design around. Like, they design games that have four players, and they're all trying to reach a particular goal, but competing against that. And so, like, if you have any game that has at least three players and they're competing for something and they can interact with one another, it will have some form of kingmaking.
Yeah. And a big part of that is that it becomes a thing that happens very naturally in games like that, where everyone has equal ability. Because when you're losing and then one player, or the two players are roughly evenly matched, mm-hmm. then all you really have to do is attack one, and then suddenly the imbalance is just unsurmountable at that point.
Yeah,
you're not playing strategically to win. You're just playing to sap 5% of the resources, which means the other player will then have the advantage. And
yeah. You
know, there's very few game systems that involve that many players where that is not a natural risk of the mechanics.
Yep, absolutely. And like I was saying, this is a thing that board game players think about more frequently. But video games have this thing going about it too, like Super Smash Brothers. If you've ever played, if you've ever been really good at Super Smash Brothers and get teamed on, that's me. I get teamed on all the time. That's an example of king making.
Was this whole topic just an opportunity for you to say that?
No, but I figure I might as well take the opportunity when I have that, while I had it. But I guess I wanted to talk about king making because, like, I think it oftentimes is presented as a problem. And I'm actually, frankly, I'm having a hard time. I keep correcting myself when I'm describing king making in situations as a problem. But it's, I don't think it's a problem. I think it's just a part of the game.
Yeah.
But you want to control how much of the game it is, how much a part of the game it is. But like it effectively, like, it changes a lot of dynamics of the game when folks are, when they get to this point, when king making is a big, strong influence of it. It could cause second. I have a list. It can cause second place to feel cheated out of a win, and other players can feel social pressure in that moment to, like, pick somebody.
Yeah,
which is, it can sometimes be bad. The more an effect it has, the more it will warp play to become more of a negotiation style game. People will start like trying to hide their position in the game, so that, like, they'll start pretending like they're doing worse than they actually are, so people don't start, like, focusing on them.
Yeah,
but it also becomes, like, somewhat of an equalizer because, like, you know, I'm sure folks have played plenty of racing games where, like, somebody's way ahead, my brother, and and you're way in last place. It's nice to have an equalizer. So, anyways, just my whole history.
Yeah. Well, what happens a lot of times is if there's a runaway leader.
Yes.
And then a distant second place.
Yeah.
And then an even further distant last place. Then both of those people teaming up against the leader can be the equalizer.
Exactly.
But it's when one and two are really close.
Yeah.
That the math doesn't really equalize anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 And I mean, it's no fun when, like, somebody's way in the lead and you recognize that and you still have, like, five turns left in the game or whatever, but you still have to play it out so this person can get their actual win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not exciting. So, like, part of king making is gameplay.
Yes.
It's an aspect. So, like, everybody still gets to participate in the victory condition without you actually necessarily getting the win.
Yeah, and that robbed of victory feeling for the person who doesn't get, you know, crowned is a consequence of games that do not lean into the political aspect of it, right? If there's no way for you to garner favor from the potential kingmaker, either mechanically or from table talk or whatever, then you felt like you really had no agency in determining whether you won or lost.
Yeah.
There are games where that alliances can happen on the couch or at the table, but players do not feel obligated to participate in that, and then they will feel cheated even if they did have the agency to do something about it.
Yes.
You know? And this is going to lead into Ellen's conversation or Ellen's talk as well.
Yeah.
But but a lot of that stuff happens outside of the actual game itself. I mean, it could really just be a case of, like, I'll give you my extra slice of pizza.
If you, if you go and take this person or whatever.
And, like, is that wrong? You know,
this is so interesting because I didn't expect there to be such a direct connection between your topic and my topic.
Because neither of you knew anything about the other's topic, and I did, and I was excited.
Yeah. Well, this happens a lot actually when I'm playing, like, larger tabletop games with Eric.
Yeah.
So, like, we often play this game called Small World, and then there's another one called Small World Underground.
Mm-hmm.
And in Small World, you occupy part of the board, and then, but you have limited resources in the current state. So you're basically playing all these different, like, fantasy species, and you're competing for space on the board, but you only have so many units of that species that you can compete with. And so when you kind of run out of those units, you have to choose to go into decline and then choose another species and then take over the board with that. So, like, you as a player win if you collect the most points, but you as, like, you keep changing, like, the species that you have. He's really good at this game.
Mm-hmm.
And it has happened a few times where he just gets so far ahead that everyone else is like, well, there's no chance of winning, so I'm just going to go after Eric, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and it bothers him a lot. It's like, that's not part of the game. It's not part of the rules. Like, it's implied.
It's implied, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the only thing that's part of this game is how much I'm winning.
Right. I do find, I actually enjoy certain games that are like this, when, like, that's the core part of the game, or it's clear to me when that's the core part of the game. I think most games aren't like, this is a king-making game. Actually, there are a couple that are. but, like, most games don't, like, explicitly say this is a king-making game. But there are other games that, like, have king-making aspects in them, but don't actually, like, foreground that in a way that like I'll recognize right away.
Yeah.
So like Civ is an example of this, and part of the reason why I don't like Civ multiplayer Civ is because those games take way too long. And so like I'm used to playing single player. So when I play single player, I basically play it like SimCity, and I'm just trying to build my cities up and stuff. And I don't really think about armies very much.
Yeah.
But like in a multiplayer game, that's bad because like
right.
if other people have armies, they'll just wreck you. And if you're not expecting it, you just get destroyed. And so like you'll spend 8 hours playing this game, building up your civilization, and then somebody comes in with a tank and blows up your capital, and you're like, well, I guess that's the game then.
That's like such a, you know, like, there's a lesson in that.
Yeah. It truly is. But like there's aspects of kingmaking with respect to that, because you could just like try to hide that you're winning, or you could convince other people that like you can give them advantages if you don't shoot me or whatever.
There's definitely an advantage to laying low when you're ahead.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think it takes a lot more of a part in civilization multiplayer.
Yeah.
I recognize when I first started.
Yeah.
So I get frustrated when we get close to the end and I'm doing really well and people recognize it and they want to nuke my cities.
yeah.
But like it's part of the game. So, like, I can't be upset at other players for doing that. I'm mostly just upset at the situation and makes me not want to play the game anymore, at least in that multiplayer setting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it could lead to some frustration points. I think, honestly, a lot of, like, if you want to make a game that leans into kingmaking, you make it shorter so that people who, like, aren't great at the diplomacy aspect don't necessarily have to participate in it for very long. Or, I guess, just make it clear that this is an aspect of the game. So if you're going to participate in it, expect to do some diplomacy.
Yeah, actually, I think that first example is like the make it short so people who aren't interested don't have to feel... I kind of disagree with that.
That's fair.
Because I feel like if it is part of the game, then your duty as a developer is to communicate that somehow.
Yeah, okay.
And then if the player doesn't like it, then they just don't like your game.
Okay, yeah, that's
right.
That's
And I think a good way to... The thing about kingmaking and partly why it's generally used as a describe something bad is because it usually is like happens at the very end of the game and it's decisive and not fun.
Yeah.
But as a mechanic, and the reason it is that way is because it's not designed for.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's essentially there are mitigations, but then those mitigations fail and then kingmaking happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's generally how people experience it in a lot of games.
Yeah.
But then there are games where that's, I mean, it's not, you wouldn't describe it this way necessarily, but the games that have lots of negotiated moments. So, I mean, the board game that comes to mind for this is Star Trek Ascendancy, where there is kingmaking that happens at the end of that game, or can happen at the end of the game. But also there are many opportunities where someone is like, you know, it looks like the Breen are going to invade Cardassia. I could have a say in this.
Yeah.
And, like, and my Klingon Defense Force can like either help or hinder.
Yeah.
All right. Who wants me to crown them, and what can you do for me?
Yeah,
and that can be part of the mechanic. That happens over and over and over in that game.
Yeah,
right.
So that when it happens at the very end of the game too, it just feels like part of the thing you've been doing all this time.
Yeah, yes.
And it's not quite as bad when you're definitely going to lose, but also you can be responsible, you know, for the Federation taking back Vulcan or whatever.
You know? No, I agree. I think Ascendancy is a good example of that, because like it does have a lot of, I mean, negotiation, literally trading is an aspect of the game. And in order to trade, you need to say, hey, do you want my trade agreement? Like, so like that, they foreground that kind of stuff.
Right. That is right. It's supported mechanically. Mm-hmm. So if you're not good at the negotiation stuff, there are tools for you to engage in that without having to do the kind of strategic off the board thinking.
Yes.
But it also really does support a lot of that off the board thinking.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
It does. Another example of this that I would think of is Root. I don't know if y'all have played Root yet.
Yeah.
I have not.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty cool.
It's very, you know, it's a local, also locally designed.
Well, if everyone I've ever talked to is right, then it sounds like it's a winner.
It is fun.
It is.
Yeah. I think you would like it specifically.
I think, for sure. It's also very complex.
I think the reason I haven't played it is because I have a natural averse to asynchronous.
Sure.
Games. And that's Leader Games' whole deal.
Yeah.
And so I think I've just like, I don't think I'll like it. So I'll just not, but you should make me play it once and maybe I will.
Give it a try. Yeah. But it, like, that game has kingmaking at its core. Yeah. Literally, the designer of the game did a talk about why kingmaking is good. We'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that this is a good example of it, because you start out at the front. Like, literally, there's a faction. They're the Cats, the Marquis. The Cats or something like that.
Those cats.
And they're just
friggin' cats.
Yeah, there's a bunch of cats all over the board. And they start out at advantage. There's already a king, and you're supposed to deal with them. So everybody, like every faction, figures out a way to deal with them, and they can, you know, you can negotiate your position around it. And it's clear who is in the lead and who is not in the lead because they have a certain amount of points. People gain points at different rates, though. So, like, you have to pay, you also have to pay attention, I guess, to how people are gaining their points. But like, it's very clear, like, that game is all about negotiating your position. In the forest or whatever that situation is. I think that's a good example of something that just leans into kingmaking and it makes it work. I find it very fun. There are ways to mitigate the effect if you don't want kingmaking to be a huge impact on your game. You can literally limit interactions between players. A lot of Euro games do this, where you mostly just like get score them. And the way you interact is literally just by, I guess, you pick a card up that they would have wanted and they don't get now.
You compete for resources rather than directly interacting or directly hindering other players.
Exactly. You can also encourage more player interactions. This is kind of how like Ascendancy does it. It doesn't exactly mitigate kingmaking's effect, but it causes more negotiation and table talk and stuff to happen during the play. So it mitigates kingmaking's influence or feeling.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Well, the worst instances of it are where things are really unbalanced at the end of the game, right? Yes. And so if you just let it bleed through the whole experience, then it'll feel less.
Yeah.
You know what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
The other thing to just add about Ascendancy is because they're all very, like, no one's playing Star Trek Ascendancy unless they already love Star Trek, right?
That's not true, but continue.
You're one of us now, Steven.
That's not what I meant.
There's this epic narrative that's unfolding across the many hours
of
that game.
It's the user story.
Right?
Right, exactly.
Which is really, and the theming really helps you be immersed in that.
Right. And so if it does come down to this kind of very kingmakery moment at the end of the game, there's all this story behind it that gives it meaning and doesn't make it feel like arbitrary.
You're not the third place player, you're in the history books.
Yes, exactly.
As having it had an impact.
Yeah, so it kind of lends this kind of epic narrative, this feeling of an epic narrative, partly because it is, because it's a really long game.
Yeah.
to those moments where it doesn't feel like something that's arbitrary and just kind of happenstance. It really feels like this is just like how the galaxy is unfolding.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the theming, having a metaphor or just a narrative of something does go a long way towards providing meaning to what you're doing. If it's just who has the most points, I get to decide who gets more points than the other, and both have more than me.
Yeah.
Then there's very little you can be satisfied with other than your personal relationship with those people. And like, oh, it'll be really funny because she really loves winning, and it'll be hilarious if she doesn't.
Teaser.
Yeah. Like, you know, or like, oh, she always wins, I'm going to let her win again. You know, because that's, you know, our little personal narrative as a friend group or whatever. Yeah. That's one thing, but the game should provide more than that if it's going to account for that.
And the theming in Ascendancy also kind of lets you, and the amount of time you spend with, like, the species that you play as, kind of lets you kind of role play a little bit.
And you know what? Like you were saying, people play it they don't play it unless they love Star Trek, and Steven was disagreeing. Mm-hmm. I think we have definitely had people play with us who then we later forced to watch a lot of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, yeah, I totally understand this because I played them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I did. I was surprised by that.
Yeah.
Because I really felt like, oh, that's sort of true, but I didn't realize how true it was.
Right. So that choice at the end, you know, when it comes to down, like it's the Klingons and the Federation and the Cardassians.
Yeah.
You know, like when you make your choice, you're also making a statement about like how you're role playing that.
Right.
Thematically. And so all that goes to say is there's a lot that goes into Star Trek Ascendancy based in the theme that creates meaning that makes those kingmaker moments not feel bad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Feels actually interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something also a relief about that as well. You're not burdened with getting the most points or getting the victory condition. You now have another task that you can complete. It's a decision to make.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And that, and you win regardless, in a sense, regardless of how you choose. But the game requires it to create an environment, and that's not always going to necessarily be a lot of story.
Yeah,
it is one way to do it, an effective way to do it. It could also be very targeted, specific narrative or story that can get you there.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question is, is like if you're making a game that's starting to has conditions that has kingmaking potential.
Yes.
And you're not essentially that interested in that.
Yeah.
And your mitigation strategies are still like, it almost seems like you are then doomed to make the game work for that unless you want a big problem on your hands.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you do if you find yourself in that situation?
I mean, you have to account for it from jump.
Yeah.
I think. Otherwise, what are you going to, like, otherwise it'll catch you by surprise.
So if you're in that situation, you're like, it's too late.
I honestly think that is the case.
Okay.
Yeah, if you get to a point where, like, kingmaking is a thing you didn't account for and it's, like, an issue with the game and it's causing the game to feel less fun, then, yeah, it's too late.
Yeah.
You can't deal with it, really, at that point, and you just kind of have to accept it.
Right.
I don't. I guess also board game. The way the board games are developed, I'm thinking about it from a board game perspective.
Sure.
The way that board games are developed, maybe they can. You can kind of start from scratch. I don't know. I assume you can't. But yeah, I just plan for that in advance. It's a good thing I'm making a topic about it, so folks know.
So kingmaking.
Yep.
Now that I understand what it is.
Yes.
It sounds like it is a. It's a word for a dynamic that is often considered problematic. But is not universally problematic, and so maybe it's termed kingmaking when it is a problem, and it's just like cool kingmaking when it isn't.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It's seen as a slur against a
yeah, it is
right. Mm. But it's been taken back by folks and mm-hmm. who like they're like actually it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And there's not really another term for that as a mechanic, so
yeah.
It's kind of it's not quite the dirty word it maybe used to be. Yeah. But some players of a particular persuasion will still use it that way almost exclusively.
Yeah,
because they don't like it or they feel that games that have it failed in some way.
Yeah,
kind of like the idea of points, badges, and leaderboards. Like this is a term that comes from gamification.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Points, badges, and leaderboards. Not that no one knows what points, badges, and leaderboards are, but like strung together in that specific
line, phrase. Tigers, and bears.
Yes. Yes. Oh.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Points, badges. So, like, if you string it together in that certain phrase, basically what that's saying is like, it's not a really deep system of gamification. Right. Someone just slapped some points, badges, and leaderboards on it. And now it's gamification. You should, like, be excited.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that you should never have points, badges, and leaderboards. It's just like they should mean something.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's got to be a purpose to it.
Yeah. Same thing. You can have kingmaking. It just has to be interesting.
You will have kingmaking. So try to make it interesting. It's my argument.
Yeah. Put that on a t-shirt. And then explain what it means to people who ask you.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, it's been a long time since we talked about GLOM, I feel like.
GLOM!
I was waiting for that.
I feel like every time we say it's been a long time, I don't know that it has.
Well, sure, but I was going to explain the rules and stuff so people remember how to play.
Oh, yeah?
It's been a while since I've played it, too, so I hope I do it right. you get a phrase. It could be like, I had eggs this morning. That's not one of the phrases.
I like that, there are actually. Better
phrases. You get this phrase, and everybody's tasked to rewrite the phrase using words that are not in the phrase.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have a rule that you have to follow while you're doing it. And the rule could be you're not allowed to use any T's, for instance. But you're scored based off of this gold card. And the gold card could be most vowels used in the sentence.
It sounds like impossible.
It sounds impossible.
The specific conditions you've strung together, I'm trying to make a sentence in my head, and it's garbage.
Well, conveniently, every time you have 3 minutes to come up with an actual word, we call it.
Right, so if it's particularly hard, it'll be over soon.
Yes.
But that's one of the great things about GLOM, is that because the three decks provide thousands and thousands of possible gameplay rounds.
Yeah,
some of them are strikingly easy, and you spend all your time trying to come up with a better one.
Yeah,
like here's one, and some of them are real stumpers.
Yeah,
and so the experience really changes as you play through multiple rounds.
Very true.
And every player has the same set of challenges in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a party game.
Yep.
About wordplay. Mm-hmm. But all the scoring is objective.
Yeah.
So there's none of that kingmaking.
Yeah. Right. There's not, actually. Yeah.
And the variety is essentially endless.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's very fun. Gosh, we should play GLOM again.
So we've been hyping up this GLOM game, but why are we talking about this card game? What's going on?
Because we developed it.
Oh, dang. That's right. It's a game from the Clubhouse of Nice Games Club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we made it at a game jam. We developed it a little bit further. We got the publisher, and they published the game. And it's out. You can buy it at stores. You can find out more information at nicegames.club/GLOM.
I got a sentence.
What?
Around 6 a.m., she slapped some quiche upside my face.
Perfect. I do appreciate you actually came up with one.
It's really hard to do.
Yeah, you did it fast.
20 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you said no cheese, and I was like, plate, table, oh no. And I was like, quiche doesn't have a tea. It has eggs in it. It's a really great mental image.
Yeah. Do I get to guess what your topic is now on, or?
I mean, the issue you and I had leading up to recording this episode
yes.
is that you didn't like the title that I had.
Yeah.
Which, and now that I have off-screen gameplay as the title for the topic, I literally cannot remember what the other title was.
Oh, gosh. It was thinking time or something.
Thinking time?
See, that's
thinking
why,
moments?
That's why it was a bad topic, Dad.
I think the word thinky was also
I tossed
suggested.
Around thinky today, like thinky yeah. bits.
Yeah.
Yeah, none of those are great. Sorry, Alan.
That's fine.
So what is this topic? Can you explain it for listeners and me?
There's probably a better way of explaining this, but the way that I was thinking about it when we first added this to the list of things we wanted to talk about on the show
mm-hmm.
was like, okay, so you're playing a game of some sort.
Yeah.
And I was thinking like a puzzle game, like Baba Is You or TikTok, A Tale for Two, something that my sister and I recently played.
Okay.
Lots of T's in that one. Just saying. And then like, so you're playing the game and all of a sudden like you hit a part where it's like not obvious or intuitive what you need to do.
Yeah.
And then you like stop and you sometimes take your hand off the keyboard or off the mouse or off the board and you're like, huh? And you kind of look at things and you think about them. And what I was thinking about is like, okay, you're not interacting with the game anymore, but you're still playing it. And I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. This is an interesting thing about certain types of games. And I kind of want to just explore the edges of this idea and like, what does that look like in different genres? And is it something you can design for? And what are, you know, like what should we call that moment other than off-screen gameplay? Mm. And maybe that is the best title. It's probably better. And I do agree with Steven. It's better than Thinky Bits.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure Dale would agree. I think Dale would probably be on board with Thinky
Bits. Well, that's not fair. Dale's like the ultimate decider on that. You can't tell her the title.
She's the kingmaker?
Yes. Okay. Always.
Right. Okay. We won't ask her.
I'm going to put an end to this bickering.
All right, cool.
And I want to like lead off my approach to this topic and saying, this is my very favorite thing in games.
Yeah, high five.
Like,
oh, all right.
It's the best thing about games.
Interesting.
Is the ability for you to engage with it intellectually without requiring you to engage with it physically.
Okay.
That is like the ultimate success of a piece of interactive art.
Explain it better than for me so I could get on board with it more.
Okay, so I'm going to skip ahead in this outline because Ellen, you asked us to come up with some examples of games that have this or do this well.
Yeah.
And the one I want to talk about is Return of the Obra Dinn.
Okay.
Which is a puzzle game, so it really fits the rubric that Ellen is laying out at the top of here. The idea of the Return of the Obra Dinn is that you have all of these people who died on this ship, and you're an insurance adjuster, and you're investigating. You know, there's supernatural scenario, but basically, you have to find out how they died, who killed them. I mean, you're basically playing 30 games of Clue.
Yeah.
Right?
Cool.
And the mechanics are walk around and look at stuff.
Right.
That is essentially all that's available to you in that game. And it is some of the most rich intellectual gameplay you will have in any game ever made.
Okay.
And a lot of it is just you looking at the screen going, well, but, oh, maybe that. Uh-huh. And that is the game.
Yeah.
And that is so exciting to me.
Okay.
And now, which is not to say that the less interaction, the better.
Yeah.
But what it is, it's an efficient use of interactive elements.
Okay.
To provide an interactive experience. It's like bang for your buck. In a sense. That's what excites me about it.
Yeah, like the maximum neural activity for your lines of code.
Not going to lie, I'm more lost than I was before.
Shoot.
Yeah.
Okay, no,
I tried.
Can I make an attempt?
Please. Okay.
You remember that Game Jam game that we did?
Yeah. With
the funky little dungeon creatures?
Uh-huh, yeah.
It was the first Game Jam we did together.
It was, yeah.
It was
Dicer
a lot of
and Clasp, yeah.
Yeah, Dicer and Clasp, Dungeon Skedaddle.
Mm-hmm. I forgot the subtitle part.
Side note, Google Docs has opinions on how you spell skedaddle.
Okay.
Which is interesting. Mm. Anyway,
I feel like that's just a way of you saying you disagree with how Google Docs is spelled.
Well, I just think that you should have the option of spelling it with two E's in the middle. Obviously, there's only one E at the end, at the end of daddle.
Right, of course.
But like,
you and I have fought about like M dashes and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how you're like, but spelling is whatever, who cares?
I just, what if you want to say it skedaddle? You know, skedaddle. Whatever. Okay.
Anyways.
I meant that to be a side note and it took us way further. So the whole idea of that game was you have limited information between the two players.
Right.
And so a lot of the gameplay actually is like trying to explain what you see on the screen or on the, both screens, right?
Yeah.
One player had a map on screen, the other person was controlling the little critters.
Yeah.
And the idea being that one of the critters was off screen holding the map and the other critter was in the dungeon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they had like a radio, I think they were talking. Right. So
yeah.
A lot of the gameplay, the thing that's actually fun, is trying to explain to the other person what is going on in this ridiculous environment. Like, well, there's a dungeon and then there's a door and then like the map was there, but the map was static and the dungeon wasn't. Mm-hmm. Right. So like the gameplay was happening really between the two computers.
Yeah.
Through the players' communication with one another.
Sure.
Not actually in the video game.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's like the gameplay happening like above the table that is what we're talking about here. Obviously there's also gameplay that happens like when you're moving bits around on the table or you're pressing the keys that going WASD and you're clicking or you're moving the joysticks. There's a lot that's happening there. But
what we're
talking about here is moments where the gameplay completely detaches from that type of, from the actual physical interaction.
From the input. Mm-hmm. Okay.
From the input of the system, whether it's a tabletop system or cards or computer or console.
Yeah.
But the game experience continues purely like mentally.
Yeah.
Or up here, you know?
There's a test you can run to see if this is happening.
Okay.
Which is if you can automate the playing, like say you can do a computer aided speed run.
Yeah.
For Mario.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But you really couldn't do that for this type of mechanic because it would just happen instantly, but it wouldn't actually be playing the game.
Oh, okay, sure. So, like, there are speedruns of Clue where they're done in 3 seconds because they just go through the menu and they guess the thing and it happens to be right because they've tried it 1,000 times until they got it right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like that.
Yeah, essentially, it's the gameplay that cannot be automated.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like, the thing that you're playing with is the fact that you're dealing with a slow meat computer.
Okay.
You know? Like, and that is the human brain.
Yeah.
And you only got a lot fewer cycles per second that you're dealing with, you know? And, like, that's what you're playing with is kind of that stretching those moments out and making them fun.
Okay. I have an idea in my head of what it is, but I think it's wrong. So I'm going to start throwing out examples.
We're looking forward to this.
Yes.
Is trash talk a form of this?
I would say no.
I really like that you asked that question.
Yeah.
It does open it up a little bit.
Well, because, I mean, I don't know. You were talking about, like, the gameplay that's not part of the game. And, like, I don't know. It can be fun.
Well, now we're talking about Ellen, you and I are thinking in terms of like puzzle games, right? Of like solving a challenge.
Sure.
Steven, and, I mean, you're talking about competition and multiplayer experiences.
Yeah.
And so that's probably why the lens is a little bit different.
Yeah.
We could bridge these things.
Yeah.
Sure.
So certainly there are things that happen that are, I mean, there's meta that's independent from mechanic, right?
Yes.
And certainly in multiplayer games, trash talk is a way to influence the outcome. But not using the tools that are provided by the mechanics of the game.
I mean,
so it's in the neighborhood.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, I don't trash talk isn't always used to like psych out your opponent. Sometimes it's just fun to make quips at your opponent's expense.
Sure.
But like, you know, in a fun
way. Well, in that case, it's even closer because it's part of playing a game is enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
Right? It's not always just completing a task.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
I mean, how many people like will play a game and they won't optimize their experience because it's more fun to jump around than it is to race to the end.
Absolutely.
So that's the same thing, right? Is if you're just using it to have a good time, and that's the experience, part of the experience of playing,
that
takes it away from our sort of intellectualization of it that Ellen
and I
brought
part to
it.
Of why
but
I'm
it's
having,
not that different.
I think that's part of why I'm having a hard time with it, because like, I mean, like, I do enjoy puzzle games. I don't enjoy them as much as Mark does, because I guess it's his favorite part of games. I don't know. I think the most fun I have in a puzzle game is when I come up with a solution and I was like, oh, that was a fun solution and process. But not like, oh, I enjoy thinking about this thing for 3 hours and then coming up with a solution after a while. That does not seem as appealing to me. It's more that I got to the point and then there's a release. Of endorphins because I actually finally solved it after putting in that much effort.
Okay, so compare that to, say, a round of Super Meat Boy.
Okay.
Where it's like, you know, white knuckle, you know, precision button pressing.
Yes.
That is not the same as reaching the end and winning that
correct.
Level, right?
Yeah.
Completing that level. But map that to your example, which is the spending all that time sussing it out.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is enjoyable is the completion.
Yes.
But would that be as enjoyable if someone just handed you a card with the answer on it and you got to do the here's what it is?
Well, yeah. No, it's not as enjoyable.
So that maps to the experience of playing a level.
Sure.
Where the process is enjoyable.
Yeah.
Right? I beat him.
Beat is not accurate. I see where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's like I put in this effort and I'm getting rewarded with the victory.
Yeah.
That's what's the fun about it. But in order for the victory to feel satisfying, I had to put in some effort to do it. But I don't find the effort necessarily fun or interesting.
Well, fair enough.
Okay. But I mean, like, I guess
That's fine.
But I think what we're saying
but just
is
arguing that the effort.
Yeah.
The effort is independent from action.
Yes. I understand.
Right. Yeah.
I understand that part.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Like whether that's pressing buttons in the right order,
you can spend
piecing together clues in your head.
You can spend 3 hours trying to figure out how to beat a Dark Souls boss. You can spend 3 hours trying to figure out how to finish this puzzle in Braid or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but like that's this. If I'm understanding this correctly, that's the same kind of effort. Y'all are just talking about specifically in like a puzzle game or even in an action game when you're trying to figure out how to complete this thing. That aspect is interesting and enjoyable for y'all, but like it's effort you're putting in order to complete the game.
Yeah, it is. I guess I haven't really been thinking about it in terms of genre specific like limitations.
Well, so I mean another an example I was thinking of that's not exactly like this, but like doesn't necessarily have to be a competition sort of thing is theory crafting.
Yeah.
Because like you I guess speed running is a form of competition. But like I think of this with respect to like Spirit Island, because I play it a lot, too. Not as much as now, because I'm playing Dragon's Dogma 2 too much. But
we know.
But I'll like spend some time thinking about how I could use certain cards in certain ways, or use this spirit's ability in this way in order to beat this adversary on the highest difficulty or something like that. And I do find that engaging. And well, I guess I do a decently enough where I would argue that I find it fun, obviously. So, but that doesn't sound like the kinds of things that y'all are talking about. I guess it is off-screen gameplay, and then I'm thinking about the game, but I'm not like I'm thinking about solutions to problems that aren't actually, or to puzzles that don't exist.
Yeah, and I think I'm really glad you brought up that example too. And
okay.
The reason I am is because like really what I wanted to talk about was like this pattern and this feeling, this type of experience, which I'm calling off-screen gameplay, and maybe that's not, again, the best solution for it. And it doesn't have to be you worked on this puzzle in the Myst game for 3 hours and you finally got it. It can be, you know, I was thinking about it, or it's just like this moment where you're disengaging from...
Even if you just spent like a minute on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You're disengaging from the system of interaction, but you're still playing.
Okay.
And that specific moment, that specific dynamic is interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But the reason I like that you're bringing up these examples is because it's kind of testing the borders of what that feeling is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So like theory crafting to me feels really different.
Okay.
But I don't know, is it categorically different? But if it is, why?
And that's part of why I'm confused.
Yeah.
Well, it's outside it's a similar thing you're doing,
okay,
but the context is different because you're not playing the game at that moment.
That's fair, yeah.
Right? It's the difference between running on the treadmill and then entering a marathon.
Okay.
Right? They're both running.
Yes.
But one of them is the running is actually like doing the marathon.
Okay.
And the other one is practicing or training.
Or prepping for.
Or prepping. But the action is literally left foot, right foot. It's exactly the same.
Yes.
So I think that's the difference between poring over strategies and thinking about it versus actually engaging in that type of thinking in situ, right? While playing.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe like the degree of proximity to the gameplay is still important, or something about the context switching. Because when you're theory crafting, you're often like going out there and finding resources to solve a specific problem that you want to then execute the solution in the game. So like, you know, you're going through and you're looking at all the different available things you can like select and chase down and farm in Path of Exile. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. It's complicated.
Yeah.
But like, so you're going through all these websites and you're finding all the things that you want and you're putting together your plan.
Yeah, like you're setting up a build.
Yeah, you're setting up a you're setting up a build, and that is fun.
But it's not what we're talking about.
I don't know. I'm asking that. I guess I'm testing
it
out the idea.
It sounds like that's not what Mark is arguing it is.
I would say it's a very similar action, but the context is the relevance.
Sure. Yeah, I think so, because the thing is like when you're theory crafting to that degree and you're putting together their build, you are focused on the build. And you've chosen to focus on that build because you know that having a good build will improve your experience of the game. But you're not actually playing the game at that point.
But okay.
Right?
I mean, like, I agree to some extent. I guess, like, when you're making a build, it's not necessarily an optimal build. It could just be a fun, interesting way to play the game.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
In which case, you're thinking about how you want to play the game, but not what to do to play the game.
Wow, this gets hard, right? So you see how it was so difficult to come up with a good title for this?
Yeah. Well, I think that the difference really is just about strategizing versus executing.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And Ellen is describing engaging with the mechanics of play without engaging with the physical apparatus of play.
Yes.
Right? Without hitting any buttons or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, whereas the strategizing and planning uses some of the same mental muscles, perhaps.
Yeah.
But is not, you're not executing. You're not actually solving or building or creating or piecing together.
Okay.
Or you know what I mean? And that moment where you're, there is a difference, right? Now, you could be playing a game and be at the screen where you configure whatever.
Yeah.
And then you could start to think about all the different ways you could do it.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what Ellen's talking about, even though the game is active right now.
Okay.
I think that's more the same thing you're doing when you're doing it later.
Mm.
Right, or doing it prior.
Sure.
I think it's much more. I'm trying to speak generically, but then it just kind of comes out as a big.
Yeah, no, I'm really like there's something there's. I feel like there's something here, but I'm running into like maybe there isn't a strong boundary.
Yeah, I guess that's well, part of it is like you were very enthusiastic about how much you enjoyed this in the beginning, Mark, and I wanted to feel like that too. But yeah. Then I was like, this I don't feel like that when I'm playing a puzzle game. I'm more excited that I put in this effort and I got rewarded by completing the thing.
Yeah, I think puzzle game is the clearest example.
But
I think we might be hung up on puzzle game.
But I mean, like, even in situations that aren't like puzzle games,
yeah.
I enjoy strategizing about like builds and stuff. I don't necessarily want them to be optimal. I just want them to be kind of fun and interesting.
Yeah.
For me. And so like I enjoy that outside of gameplay thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it sounds like that's not what this is. In which case it kind of feels like I just don't enjoy whatever this is. So like I guess that's fine.
Well,
like,
I mean,
I don't know.
Let's think of it outside of the sort of solving a puzzle or piecing together a thing.
Yeah.
Let's say a Mario game where you're going through and there's like three different paths you could take.
Yep.
This is more likely a Sonic game, but like.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, one of the fun things in Mario games is that there'll be these like sort of half tunnels
that
don't reveal themselves until you run into the wall and realize this thing. Mm-hmm. There's just a little visual clue to that.
Mm-hmm.
Spotting that.
Yes.
Is this moment.
Okay. Okay.
In the minutest way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think. Right.
I think so.
Where you're taking an input from the game and then you're piecing together how to do it, but you're not, for example, mechanically using a little magnifying glass and moving it around the screen until the thing is revealed.
Yeah. So right. Like, Metroid's another example. So like you're running around and you're like, okay, as long as you're not being chased by scary robot, you're like, okay, where are the secrets? Where are the secret passageways? And you're running and running, and you can just keep jumping at all the parts of the wall to try to find the things. But sometimes you're running and running and then you stop and you're like, does that square look funky? Does that square look funky? Does that square look funky? Mm-hmm. And I'm still playing the game, but I'm not using any of the inputs.
Yeah, and that you're looking for context.
Yeah.
Right. Now let's compare that to Baba Is You.
Yeah.
Baba Is You, the mechanic is push.
Yeah.
Well, the mechanic is verb. There's
yeah. So you put the,
it could be anything.
The yeah. The input is yeah. Good point. Yeah. The input is you move the thing and it moves another thing and then stuff changes, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah.
And so when I got stuck in Baba Is You, I just pushed stuff.
Yeah.
I just moved around the screen and went, does this move? Does this move?
Mm-hmm.
Does this move?
Mm-hmm.
What if I did this? What happens when I, you know, so like I was still, it's a different kind of solving, a different kind of progressing.
Yeah, it's wild that that's your example, because I think Baba and You, for me anyway, because there's lots of times where you do trial and error.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really good example where you can stop and plan out the next five moves and do that thinking without having to test it, because you know enough about the systems that you can kind of play it out in your head.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, that won't work. And then you don't have to try it because you've worked it out in your head that
yeah.
it won't work.
And you can, yeah. And I'm sure that I played some moments in Baba Is You like that.
Yeah.
But I also like very much like experimenting with physicality. So like,
yeah.
It's weird. I feel like it's weird that I brought up this topic because I do occasionally just go jump at the walls. You know, Baba Is You is a great example. Yeah. I got stuck. Well,
it's a great comparison because it's both of those things, working it out in your head or trying it out on the screen. Those are the same action.
Kind of, yeah.
Right?
From a gameplay perspective, from like a game design, from a goal perspective, yes.
Right. So the developer doesn't know, if you reach that result, the developer could imagine you did it in either of those ways.
Yeah.
The game will not, unless it's keeping a ton of track of stuff, it's not going to really care.
Yeah, unless you're a widget satchel and you literally track every action.
Right.
Then they aren't going to, the developer's not going to know how you got the solution. They're just going to know that you got there. I guess one other... Wordle is another one.
Mm-hmm.
So I play Wordle.
Gosh, Wordle is a good example.
Yeah.
I don't like playing Wordle.
Well, one of the things that's really fun about Wordle is that you can't type in nonsense.
Yes.
And the Wordle-like game that I made last year with Noodle, you can.
Yeah.
Because we had to make a game that someone could bring their own content to.
Right.
And a lot of the content people are bringing is like very specialized and honestly to someone off the street is nonsense.
So as a white label product, you can give it to a client and they can enter in their own correct answers.
Yes.
But you also have to account, you can't tell, they also shouldn't, you're not forcing them to provide their own dictionary.
Exactly.
Possible answers.
Right. Because we didn't,
that's
would be
too much to ask of a client.
It's too much to ask of a client, right? But for Wordle Classic,
mm-hmm.
By the New York Times, you can't type in nonsense. But the thing is like, I really, at least in Wordle, I really need to see the letters on the screen to plan the word out. So like, I type in a word. I always start with crane. Yeah. I start with crane. Mm. And if that doesn't give me much, then I go with hoist.
Do you have a Wordle word?
I think I use a do.
Oh, yeah. That's the one people say.
Yeah.
A do.
Oh, is that the one people say? I don't know. It just has a lot of vowels
in it. Yeah. I use after. It's the one I use.
Oh.
I don't know if it's any good. I just like it.
Okay.
That's fine. Yeah. That's just a perfectly good example. Mm-hmm. Eric starts with a different word every day. I think that's insanity.
Yeah. That's nonsense.
That's wild.
You should file divorce papers immediately.
I can't. The way his mind works is way too interesting.
You'll observe him. Like,
what is he going to start with this time? Yes. That's what happened. Like, what did you start with this time? Anyway.
Oh, wow.
I think statistically I do better, but once in a while he just knocks it out of the park.
Well, yeah, of course, really he tries every
exactly, game. and that's interesting.
Wordle's a great example. You cannot be good at Wordle, like there's but it really makes you feel like you can.
Yeah,
and that's kind of its charm.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I'm just saying I probably solve it in three more than he does.
let the record reflect.
Well, now I'm gonna go look at some stats when I get home.
Oh, yeah,
walk in the door, Eric. Show me your phone. I want to see your Wordle stats. So like one of the things I do with Wordle, like, and this is actually bringing up Eric is a great counterexample because the way he plays it is he'll type in his starting word, whatever chaotic choice that is,
mm-hmm.
and then he'll stop and he'll look at it. And then he'll type in the next word and enter it. And me, I type in my word and it's crane.
Yeah.
And then I go, that sucked. And I type in hoist and I'm like, okay, that's better. And then I'm like, okay, what goes next? And then I'm like, and then I type in a couple letters and I try to think about letters that I want to use.
Yeah.
And then I try to think about what words are going to have those letters, but I have to see, I like to have them shown on the screen so I can think about the words.
Yeah.
And
I'll type in a lot of things and then
delete them. Yeah.
Without entering or even trying.
Exactly. And not even trying to make sense of, like, make a sensible word, but just like try out letters in the space.
Eric just does that in his head.
He does it in his head.
But it's the same thing.
It's the same thing. Yeah. It is the same. It's the same, like, game action, I guess.
Yeah.
In the sequence of play, it is choosing another word to make your attempt.
Right. Yeah.
But I am, like, leveraging more of the interactivity to do that, where he's doing it all in his head.
Right.
Sure.
And so that's just another interesting example. It's the same thing that I was doing with Baba is You. It's just like, if I do this, does this shake anything loose in my head? But that's not, you know, I don't like necessarily doing that all the time. Like, when I get to a point in like Metroid Dread where I'm stuck, I don't like just flying at, okay, sometimes I do shoot at everything.
Well, yeah, it's easy.
But that feels just like an Ellen thing rather than related to your particular relationship with Metroid.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like systematically shooting at everything. It's more of an expression of
It's really mostly when you're bored or frustrated.
Right.
Kaboom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or so, like, exactly, bored or frustrated, kaboom.
Yeah.
Shoot the missiles. Yeah. Just try again. Mm-hmm. But then, like, okay, where do I go next? Stop and think, oh, maybe this part of the map. Open up the map. Think about it. You know, like, different game, different way of solving the problem. And it's the thing that's interesting to me, and I think that it made me want to discuss this as a topic, even as frustratingly inaccurate or like unspecific as it has been, Stephen, is like, some games I do like playing with the interactivity to try to solve the puzzle.
Yeah.
And other games I don't.
Yeah.
And what is different about those different games and why? And that difference is interesting to me.
I see.
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is that there are some games that give you the option to use the mechanical tools or to sit back and game it out in your head.
Yeah.
That, like Wordles like that and Baba Yu's like that, you could do it either way. And then there are games where there are no tools. There are no mechanical tools. That's what I think interests me the most is that design space of like actually designing a game that requires a player to do that and giving them no other option, not as a way to restrict them, but as the correct way to design this game.
Right.
Okay.
And that makes it really separates game design from app design in a much realer way. And that's why I'm so excited about the thing. It's like, and certainly action games are very much more tied to this because it's the more direct metaphor.
Yeah.
But at the same time, even those games have those potential.
Yeah.
Where you could say, what's the most purest expression of this gameplay mechanic? It's like, by not building anything at all. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's not easy, and it is kind of hard to explain, which is why those examples where it can work both ways, I think, is a good way to understand the concept.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, I have another example. I don't mean to belabor the point, but I'm trying to understand whether or not I even like this thing. and I mean, if I don't like it, it's fine, because, you know, I don't have to like everything about games. Years ago when I first played through Fez, I wanted to 100% everything. In order to 100% everything, you needed to get all those yellow cubes.
Yeah.
In order to get all the yellow cubes, there were like a bunch of signs and stuff in a language that I didn't understand, so I had to translate those.
Yeah.
And at the time I didn't know that the game had a clue to how to translate things. and so like I had to learn cryptography, sort of, in order to translate all of the different characters.
Yeah,
it in the moment I hated it.
but now, years later, you can bring it up on this podcast.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I still kind of hate it, but I appreciate the experience a lot. But like I spent a lot of time outside of the game, literally doing cryptography and learning which one of these characters is the E. Oh, this is the E. I could try to map those in the. All the other signs.
I kind of want to stop you right there because you said it outside the game.
Yeah, okay.
I think that makes this, I don't think this is it then.
What?
Because outside the game.
Oh, I give up then. Okay.
Well, I was actually, so this is going to be interesting, Steven.
Yeah.
I think it does count.
Yeah?
Well, because I was literally looking at the game and writing up stuff, but I looked up stuff. Like, I looked up how to do cryptography, and that makes it not count?
No, I just the way you describe it. As,
I mean, I literally put the controller down but wrote down what all the signs were.
You had the game up.
Yes.
And you were like making notes.
Yeah. Is making notes part of this?
This is an interesting question, right? And I think, so like I did this a lot back in the day with Myst.
Yeah.
Right? And like still, that game makes me frustrated.
Yeah.
Because the interactivity was so limited.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? Like, you wanted to experiment, and you just didn't give you anything to work with.
Yeah.
And...
Okay.
So, you would make lots of notes and be like, this, screw it, I'm done. Play a different game.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, I think of that as... Yeah, I think it is still part of that.
Okay.
But you're not using the interactivity that they gave you. You are not using the game mechanics that are built into the code or built into the system on the board.
I was thinking about the game, but like on paper, I guess, instead of... Because I'm not going to be able to hold all of these characters and stuff in my head and piece out which one's the E.
Yeah.
I had to write it down.
Yeah, and they...
I would describe that as a candidate for a type of interaction that does not... That is not improved by not forcing it all into your head. Right, because it's too much for your head.
Sure.
Right?
Oh, so it's too complicated, and so, like, because I can't hold it on in my head, it doesn't count?
I guess I'm still thinking back to, Ellen, how you described it, that moment where you sit back and figure it out and then re-engage.
Yeah.
Rather than getting out a different set of tools.
Yeah.
Because you could, for example, have built those tools into the game.
Yeah.
They did. Stephen just didn't find them.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And so, that's neither here nor there, I guess. But I guess you could imagine a version of the game that is not that, and therefore, I would say, doesn't quite meet my high standard for this, essentially. I
mean, well, here's the original packaging of Myst came with a themed notebook.
Yeah, yeah.
They planned for you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it's a different category. Maybe this is a continuum, not something that you can draw clear lines around.
Spectrum or something.
Especially since some games might be enough for Eric to hold them all in his head and not for me. And that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it is more of a continuum than a category, but I like the idea of thinking about it explicitly because I think that is a really satisfying moment. And I wish it had a better name than off-screen gameplay.
Mm. I wonder if there's a chess term for this, because the thinking 15 moves ahead, is that right? It's you're just staring at the board, and playing the game.
Yeah, suppose so.
Maybe I'm sure there's a they have a glossary and they have a name for that.
Yeah,
I think one thing that, and I have no idea how long we've been talking about this topic for, probably longer than we planned.
A good while.
Yes, a good while.
Yeah, we're well past an hour.
Okay,
all right.
Your nice games .com/feedback. So one thing I just. Because I want to bring everything back to everything, mm-hmm. like we do on the show.
Yes, we do.
One way I also was thinking about this, and it was in terms of mental processes.
Yeah, okay.
So I've talked about educating intuition so much.
Yes.
Still not done with it.
Wait a minute. I thought you were really close to done with it, 4 months ago.
I was. I am. I was and I am.
All right, well, we'll check back with you in June.
Yeah.
I was going to bring it down this week to read.
Mm-hmm.
And then I scheduled too many fun things with friends, and I haven't had any time to read.
Yeah.
Also, I forgot the book.
You were going to reference this book, though?
Yeah. I don't need to finish it anymore. I've already got the good chunks out of it, but now it's literally just a matter of getting all the yellow cubes.
Yeah.
Anyway. So you have System 1 and System 2. System 1 is the intuitive system. System 2 is the deliberative system.
Okay.
There might be a System 3, but she hasn't gotten that part of the book yet.
Right.
I doubt that it's going to be in the last 20 pages. Literally, that's all. But you guys, this book is
so
dense.
Dry, I know.
20 pages is obviously I can't even do it in 4 months. Jeez. Okay. Anyway, so I think the behavior.
Yeah.
That I have observed in myself of going and pushing the blocks around in Baba Is You, hoping for something to shake loose, and the behavior of punching in random letters into Wordle, hoping it'll spark something, is an attempt to me to spark that System 1 thinking.
Okay.
Like, I am putting, I'm putting stimulus on the screen in the environment to try to spark some intuitive thought that goes, try this. Yeah. And then I try that, and it is experimental. And so that's the intuitive thought where you're like, try this, experiment, get result, go fast. And it's not necessarily a faster system of solving the problem, but it is a faster mode of thinking where it's like action result, new action result. And that's a very fast, ping pong kind of game.
Yeah.
The deliberative system is more like chess or something where you are, you are thinking slowly and thinking hard and thinking big and taking these big actions. And I feel like that, those moments where you sit back and you go, that's a deliberative action. And you can do, you can solve those puzzles using either system.
Yeah. Well, and to do the deliberative way, you need to have a really strong understanding of the whole mechanical system so that you can predict its responses without having to provide any inputs.
Yeah.
Right. And that, that may be the definition, really, is to, is a game that you can understand so well without having to prod at it, like with a, the A button, right? And that can happen in small chunks, right? So games don't have to be so digestible mentally to provide for you to make do the whole game like that. Chess is one where you could, right? Mm-hmm. You know what all the inputs or potential outputs of them are, right? At least one at a time. Then you start going past three moves and it gets, you know, infinitely complicated, and that's the big skill of chess. But being able to do that in a video game or a board game, but that's why there are ways to do it both ways, because you could say, like, well, I'm going to prod at this with the tools that are available to me so I could learn what those, what the responses are. And that's really fast, that ping pong thing you're describing. Or I can sit and, because I can suss out, I can work out what it will do, then I'll just do it that way, because that might save me time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting when you say that is, like, maybe the reason I enjoy those deliberative moments in a Metroid game is because I've played so many Metroid games.
Right. That you're a stronger player when you're in that mode, in that game.
Yeah. I have trained myself on the system of Metroid level design.
Yeah.
Metroidvanias and all the other, you know, all the games in that genre that I have played, I've trained my understanding of those games really well, that I can have an enjoyable experience being deliberative. Whereas I ain't come across anything like Baba is You ever.
I mean, yeah.
So that's why I'm operating in a more intuitive mode.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think all I've determined is I don't like this thing, whatever it is, it personally.
When you have those moments, it's a success of the immersion of the experience.
Yeah, that's fair.
Right? And immersion mechanically, because you're able to rebuild the whole system in your head.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, I mean, and it makes a lot of sense that you do that with Metroid, not just because you have the experience, but because you love it so much. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Death Drives a Bus was another one.
Yeah.
I love that little game. Yeah. That was Ben Burns, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I love everything that guy makes.
Yeah. Real fun puzzle game, that one.
Yeah. And I think I had, it was that game for me was actually very much on the line between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'd be like, I'd look at the thing and I'd be like, I think it's this. And then I'd go do it and it would be right. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
But and it happened
that game punishes exploration, right? Because you only have a limited amount of moves to make. Yep. And so that's a way you can certainly design a system.
You have to think about
to force the player to engage that way and reward them for thinking that
I
way.
I definitely don't like this now. Now I'm realizing it. Because, like,
we finally landed.
Got it.
I mean, I figured.
Yeah.
But so.
We just had our suspicions up to now.
Yeah. So, oh gosh, what's the name of the game? There's a puzzle game. There's a locally made puzzle game. I can't remember the name. And also, I kind of didn't enjoy it as much, so I'm going to not think of the name. But anyways, the way that it was scored was you executing the puzzle perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
If you messed up a move, then you get scored less. Yeah. And so, like, it punished exploration. And I didn't like that because I wanted to figure it out, I guess.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to have to, like, sit there and literally do the puzzle in my head I could actually... and execute it perfectly in order to get perfect score. And sometimes, like, I actually did, like, figure it out in my head before doing it, and then I accidentally put in the wrong input or something, and I would get it wrong, and I was like, this is...
Yeah.
So
that demands it from you, but doesn't reward you enough. It doesn't give you the mental tools to be able to rebuild the system in your head, but it still forces you to...
think through it.
To process the system in your head.
Yeah.
Right. That's a failure of that, right?
I suppose.
And whereas Death Drives a Bus is a really good example of, and a lot of listeners will not be familiar with it, but as you path through, there are multiple solutions, multiple correct solutions, and then there are optimal solutions that are better than other solutions. But because the game, you can start out prodding a little bit, and then as you go, the demands on you to the stakes of every move get higher and higher. as you play, so you can ease your way into it. And while you're doing that, you're learning the system. And so I think that's I think why that balances really well. Mm. And so, I mean, again, for listeners who are not familiar, like that's the quality of a game like that is that it ramps that up necessarily, rather than hitting you with it and then demanding it of you and then not giving you any reward for getting close
or not giving you enough time to soak in the system with some of that experimental approach.
Yes.
Completely internalize it so that when you are given the challenge of doing it completely with your deliberative system, you don't have what you need to actually execute it in a way that's satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I guess we have to have Ben on the show. And the title of that episode will be Death Drives a Bus, Deliberative versus Intuitive Systems.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long title.
Yeah. I think we'll workshop it some more.
Well, until then, that's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club. We decided Threads pretty much, right?
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay. we're just going to decide whatever. All the other ones are nonsense. There, Dale will post about game dev resources and wall jumps.
Hey.
Reply on that platform or various if you happen to come across us, or email us contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. If you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello to us and your fellow listener. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Did I forget how to do this mic?
What?
Did I move it again? Is it in the right place?
Yeah, no, you're fine.
Okay.
How long have we been doing this?
I know, right?